Ladies and gentlemen, what we want to do is to want to begin very quickly with Senator Hagel. He has to catch a train at 1 o'clock, be out of here by 1 o'clock. So we want to take advantage. And first of all, let me just say a big thank you to all of you for coming. We're delighted to have you here. This is part of a series that we've started to say, how does America start thinking its way through complex problems rather than just using muscle, you know? And a lot of it stimulated from an early conversation that I had with Senator Hagel when he was in the Senate, and no one spoke more thoughtfully or forcefully during his time in the Congress than did Senator Hagel, saying America needs to find its way back to a thoughtful foreign policy. And it was that stewardship during his time in the Senate that we drew on and asked if he would be a part of the commission, and he agreed to do that. Somehow, during his schedule, his very full schedule, he also became an author and produced a fine book that outlined what America should be and needs to be doing going forward. I suspect we're going to build on that today. I would like to especially say a word of thanks to you, Senator Hagel, for coming. I know the demands on your time, and it's just terrific to have you here. So let's go ahead and begin, and let me introduce to you and welcome to the stage Senator Chuck Hagel. Thank you.
John, thank you, and good afternoon. Please continue to gobble, eat, drink, take a nap, whatever works for you. It particularly is not an irritant or will not be a bothersome development, because I had my eyes dilated this morning, and I have no idea who in the hell I'm talking to. I don't know if there's even anyone there, not any different from how it used to be in the Senate. Nobody ever listened then either, but occasionally they'd show up. So go right ahead. I know you've got a tight schedule that you need to adhere to. First, let me thank John, of course, and CSIS and the two joining organizations that have participated here today and over the last few weeks in putting this important day together, and for your efforts and your leadership and your substance, thank you. We are all better for your efforts. I also want to acknowledge my partners on the commission who you heard from this morning, some of them, not all of them. You, of course, I suspect know each of them and know of their good work, or certainly you know of their reputation, but you had an opportunity this morning to hear from them and to understand more fully why they are and have been and continue to be such important contributors to this big topic that you are exploring today. And I also want to thank John again for allowing me to participate in the commission, because I this morning, before I had my eyes dilated, worked my way briskly through the document, which you have all seen, I suppose. And I don't know of a document that I've seen recently in the last few years that more comprehensively identifies solutions and approaches and elements of a strategy that can be used to frame the challenges that face mankind, and I say mankind because every challenge today in the world is a global challenge, and also drive us toward some high ground of how do you fix the problem? What do you do about it? There's no question that we live today in a world that is more complicated, more combustible, more interconnected, more dangerous than probably ever before. Now, I haven't lived through all those years, but I occasionally read. I know that's foreign for a member of Congress, but I occasionally do that, and I listen to a lot of people who know something about these issues. And we are at that time, and we are at a time in the history of man that probably represents the most transformational, most redefinitional time ever. And that redefinition and that reorientation and that transformation that is occurring in the world today is occurring at a rate unprecedented. We've never seen anything quite like this, and you need not go much beyond the global financial crisis to see what's happening. And that financial crisis once again reminds us that every challenge is global. Every corner of the earth is dealing with this issue. Pandemic health threats. Last week, our news has been consumed with swine flu. How far it goes, how deep it goes, we don't know. Another good example of the interconnectedness of the world, and that all 6.5 billion people on the face of the earth now truly live in a global community underpinned by a global economy. So what you're exploring today are the realities of all of that, and you are delving deeper down into the societal dynamics that always dictate and always drive outcomes in politics, in government, in every facet of our lives. Politics, as we know, the process we use to work through differences, to elect leaders, to make decisions, hopefully with some consensus, that then governs. And that's what the process of politics is about. Politics just reflects society. Politics never leads society. It doesn't lead anything. It reflects. It responds. Leaders react. They respond. Occasionally in the history of the world, there's a confluence of events and dynamics that come together, and then true leadership matters. FDR, Eisenhower, Lincoln. There are times in the history of man where the right leader is critical. Most times, and they come, these development defining times come about twice every 100 years. The last time we saw such a time, I think, was right after World War II, when we essentially built a new world order. We built a new world order right after World War II. And that 10-year period that was responsible for that. And that world order held pretty well for 60 years. But like all institutions, all facets of a society, whether it's governing or business or education, they become obsolete if they do not remain relevant to the challenges. They become irrelevant. Every institution that was built after World War II, what I refer to as coalitions of common interest, they were built based on one simple premise, common interests. They were built on the basis of we would define our relationships, define the future of the world, define a world order not based on the differences that we had with each other, but based on the common interest that we had with each other. United Nations, NATO, General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which is now WTO, Bretton Woods brought IMF, World Bank, dozens of multilateral banks, development institutions were born, were built in that 10-year period. And it was all about common interests. And if we don't have a platform, a structure to work from to deal with differences, then there will be conflict and chaos. And we are seeing that in certain parts of the world today. And when you identify those certain parts of the world today, and we have two leaders in town today meeting with President Obama from, in my opinion, the most dangerous region in the world, Pakistan and Afghanistan, they represent areas that were left behind, most of the Middle East. They were left behind, did not benefit from the great strides of mankind in the last 60 years, did not benefit from those coalitions of common interest, those structures of common interest. You can go beyond those areas. Much of Latin America, much of Africa. The troubled areas of the world today were the areas that we didn't pay attention to were left behind. No individual freedoms, no hope, people chained to cycles of despair. So it's actually pretty predictable what's going to occur. Yesterday I was at American University, and kicked off a day-long seminar on Eisenhower and the Eisenhower era. And what struck me, and I confessed in the spirit of self-interest and narrow parochialism, I have been an admirer of Dwight David Eisenhower for many, many years. And I have always believed that he was one of the greatest presidents we ever had. And one of the reasons I believe that is because what did not happen in his 8 years, when a lot of bad things could have happened, but because of his leadership, he averted it. And over the years, many have categorized the Eisenhower years as kind of a boring. Well, I think most of us would take boring today. They were not boring. And when you bear down into those 8 years and what actually was accomplished, it was astounding. Astounding what was accomplished during those years. And the reason I bring Eisenhower up and what happened in American University is because it cuts right to what you're talking about today. Many of you know this, but it was Eisenhower in 1957 who assembled a group of presidents of universities. And as many of you know, he was president of Columbia for a short period of time. His brother was also a distinguished educator, president of the university. And he brought these university presidents together, all in this region and others. And in particular, one president at the time, the president of American University, after listening to Eisenhower and the reason that Eisenhower brought them together, and the reason he brought them together was to challenge American education on what are we doing about educating our young people, preparing our young people, the next generation of leaders, about international affairs, about knowledge and education, understanding the differences out there, religious differences, ethnic differences, cultural, history, regional. Because if we are all going to live on the face of the earth and share resources and try to accommodate and respect each other as best we can without going to war constantly and a constant turmoil and chaos and conflict, then we need to prepare our people. And we need to talk about what separates us, because only then, in understanding the depth of that, which is very much what the Smart Power Commission's charge was, and identifying that, and then what do you do? What does a great power like the United States do with all of its great power, to move towards some resolution and bring the world with us in some consensus? We can't do it alone. There's no issue out there that we can deal with alone. We're certainly finding that out in Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan. Great powers have limits to their power. What's going on and has been going on in Darfur, some of these areas of the world that in many ways we're not exactly powerless, But we have very limited ability to control some of these things. What does that lead us to? One of the issues, and I think one of the first issues the commission report points out, is alliances. This was what Eisenhower talked about as much as any one thing, forming alliances. This is what coalitions of common interest are about. We're going to have differences. And alliances are absolutely critical for all the reasons we know, and I believe the commission report starts out with that section. Well, yesterday's meeting, bringing together many universities and scholars and practitioners of foreign policy, which is really the framework. It's the large arc that represents our interests, because within that arc of foreign policy fits all of our national interests: trade, security, relationships, environment, energy, world health issues. There is nothing that is not in that framework, that inventory of challenges. And so that great arc called foreign policy represents it all, just as I think the commission report points out. Eisenhower understood that very, very well. And he understood it earlier than most anybody in this country. And he drove this country and alliances to start focusing on that. Hence, as a result of that meeting at the White House in 1957, the first international school, International Affairs School, was set up. And it was American University who started the first School of International Affairs in 1957. Georgetown, where I now have the privilege of teaching one class per semester and doing some lecturing, even though one of my brother Tom, who's a legitimate professor, law school professor, University of Dayton, he believes that I've set back American education by generations. But he's 2 years younger, always has lived with this envy. But he's making progress, and I'll give him your regards. But it was that framework that first put in place a formalized awareness of the importance of alliances, of foreign policy, and then as you work your way down into the depths of that, as this morning you did with the panelists that you had, and you'll continue to do that today, you start exploring in some detail, well, what are the instruments that a great power has to deal with these global challenges and these global issues that threaten not only the United States but threaten us all? Well, we have many. Force is certainly one. But again, as we found out in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we had an 11-year difficult period in Vietnam, which we found out the same, that force alone can't do it. Why should that be surprising to anyone? It shouldn't be. The history of man is full of examples of occupation armies, of invasions, of cultures, and in the end, the occupiers, the invaders, the conquerors always lose. They always lose. So what's the point? The point is we must get down deeper into the fabric of a society and understand that as well as we can. Hence the entire portfolio of instruments of power. Force, development, aid, assistance, diplomacy, intelligence, alliances, trade, all of those are instruments of power. How you harness those, how you cogently bring all those instruments together toward a purpose, toward a policy that is implemented and framed and shaped to achieve a purpose. Not just ricocheting from crisis to crisis, but actually try to shape a policy that has a purpose of some at least medium term, but certainly long-term sustainability. And we all human beings around the world, are really not very different. Now, I haven't been to every corner of the earth. I've not been to every country on earth. I've been to many. I've been to well over 100 countries. Many of you have been to far more. And I'm not an expert on any of these countries or any of these issues. But I have observed this. I don't think there's a great deal of difference between Muslims, Jews, Christians, Hindus, Buddhists, on the fundamental dynamic of how they feel about their families. Now, there are differences in rights, women's rights, but there too, let's not forget, the 19th Amendment to the United States Constitution. Half the people in this room 95 years ago could not vote. Half of this room couldn't vote. You were disenfranchised 95 years ago. In fact, unless you were a white male when this great republic was formed, you really were not imbued with all of the rights stated in the Constitution, in the Bill of Rights. In the mid-1960s, Voting Rights Act, Civil Rights Act, we needed to adjust then. If we had not had those adjustments and those self-corrections, and that's the wonderful thing about our country among many things, and a democracy, is that we have a process to self-correct. If we not had those debates and those laws, there's probably very little question whether the current occupant of the White House would be there today. So my point is, we got to frame all this up with some reality that we just didn't stroll onto the Democratic field 250 years ago as this remarkable republic that gave everybody rights. We struggled with it. We identified the problems. We worked hard. A lot of people sacrificed everything to make a better world. And isn't that really the essence of what we're talking about? Isn't that the essence of the differences of people when we go through these differences of religion or region or ethnicity or history? It is all about making a better world, because in the end, that's all that matters. You don't buy someone's loyalty. You can for a while. In Iraq, during the so-called surge, we put 125,000 Sunni on our payroll. This is the so-called awakening group. These were young Sunnis, unemployed. So we paid them about $300 to $500 a month not to kill us. Well, that helped. But does anybody here think that's a long-term fix? Because now they're going off our payroll. Most of them are off our payroll. So where is that loyalty going to be? And we armed them. And I don't think anybody in this room who knows anything about Iraq would say that things are better between the Sunnis and Shias today than they were 2 years ago. They're probably worse. So I use that as an example. Until you get down into the depth of the humanity of each of these issues, you'll never solve the problem. Now, you can put a fix on it for a while. And one thing we know for sure, we'll never have enough troops to put everywhere. I was with a former four-star general Friday night at a speech I gave down at VMI for the opening, the dedication of the George Marshall Leadership and Ethics Conference building. And this is a general who, among other positions he's held, he was also a commander of Central Command. And he said to me, you could put another 100,000 troops in Afghanistan along that border, and they would be absorbed so quickly. Because that isn't, first of all, that's not the way you're going to fix that problem, but it's just the dynamic of the mass problem, the terrain, the geography, the people, the issues. And so, yes, force is part of it, is part of it. But we have got to do a far better job with identifying, developing, framing, shaping, and then implementing these soft power forces within our policies. Now, it's not easy. It's imperfect. You make mistakes. You get ahead a couple of steps, and you get knocked down again. You go to the side for a while. But in the end, that societal dynamic, the fabric of a country and the people, is the only thing that ever will change anything. And so until we recognize, and I think President Obama does recognize this, and I've had long conversations with him, and I think his senior people, I think Secretary of State Clinton understands this. I know Joe Biden does. Joe's a very good friend. Our Secretary of Defense, Bob Gates. Bob Gates has been giving speeches the last year and a half. He sounds like a Secretary of State. He's talking about why we need more soft power. And you can't just keep giving the Pentagon more money and building up their programs and taking away the aid programs and the diplomatic programs and the assistance programs and the development programs from the State Department or from USAID. You can't do that. And here's the Secretary of Defense understands that as well as anybody. There isn't a general, by the way, out there that I've ever met who doesn't understand that. And if for no other reason, then they understand how we have overloaded our circuits using force. I mean, we've done great damage to our Pentagon and to our people. When you got these young men and women who are on their sixth tours, many of these young men and women on their sixth tours in both Afghanistan and Iraq, those tours go to four tours. They're longer than the entire length of World War II And you can't run your people like that. There'll be a breakdown. So consequently, like there are always consequences, and what you always have to be most fearful of are the unintended consequences. They come. Even with the best policy and the best leadership, you still get unintended consequences. Some of the consequences that we can identify now, for example, suicide rates, record high, divorce rates, record high, and so on and so on. So it isn't a matter of a luxury of trying to figure out a better way to do this, as these issues are dealt with in this Smart Power Commission and what you're dealing with today. It isn't a luxury or an option. It's a necessity. We don't have any choice. Or we will see the world in constant chaos. Constant chaos. And the problem will get so big, there is nothing really we can do about it. If for no other reason than the numbers are so incredibly large. I remember, and many of you do, that it was reported in the newspaper, that Secretary Rumsfeld once wrote a memo, which, as you know, he was very famous for those, referenced snowflakes. And the memo to his generals and to those in charge of policy in Iraq and Afghanistan was very simple. He wrote, "Are we creating more terrorists than we're killing?" That's a pretty good question. Well, the answer to that is yes. I mean, we know that today. We can answer the Secretary's question surely today. And why? Because our purpose was misguided? No, but your purpose cannot be framed in a one-dimensional dynamic of divine mission. There is no such thing in governments as divine mission. A divine mission of we're going to bring democracy to the world, whether they like it or not. And by God, they're going to like it. We'll send our troops in to show them about democracy. Divine mission should be left to missionaries and not a government. That's, again, why Eisenhower understood this far, far sooner than anyone did. Alliances, first part of the Smart Power Commission report. And then as it goes down through all of these different facets. Well, I have... informed you of nothing profound. I am incapable of that, but I think every now and then it is useful to inventory these things and state them in a way that they can be seen and used as very practical, functioning parts of policy. And I believe, and I believe this not only because of the current leadership of this country, but I believe it also as I watch young people and listen to young people and observe young people. I have an 18-year-old daughter and a 16-year-old son. Now, they're not ready to take over the country. If you ask my son, he'd say yes. But my daughter is more thoughtful about it, and I watch these young people, and I've stayed close to young people all my life, 12 years in the Senate. I never went back to Nebraska without putting some kind of an event on with a school. And I was in Nebraska a lot over 12 years. I always went to a grade school, high school, college, technical school to stay connected. Listen. Didn't give a speech. We just go around the room and talk about whatever they want to talk about. This next generation is going to be a pretty special group of young people. And we must prepare them like every generation must prepare the next generation. In many ways, I think we've not done a very good job of that. None of us are perfect. But I don't know. There's just something instinctive about this next generation that I see and I feel. And I'm as a father and a citizen, a former policymaker in this country, a veteran, I feel pretty good about the future with all the problems we have. And I feel as good about it, yes, these young people. I think the current leadership gets this. But we have a system that allows us to shift and to change and, as I said, self-correct. And we also have a nation that has an astounding amount of just good common sense. And I think that's a reflection and probably the most significant strength of this country, that we are this quilt that has been knitted and crocheted and whatever you like to do in that business, together with all these variations of color and background and history and creed and traditions and religions, and somehow that has brought a tolerance and an intuitive respect. I mean, we've had our problems and we've made mistakes, and it hasn't always been exactly that way. And it won't be exactly perfect. But that's the strength of this country. And I think reflected in the Smart Power Commission report is much of that. Because in the end, as I conclude, in the end, every community in the world, every region in the world is basically the same, is basically the same. And we must strive to knit all those samenesses and, as Eisenhower said, those common interests together and build a world fabric. And I'm not talking about a world government, so the blue helicopter crowd, the blue helmets and all that, I mean, the black helicopters, I'm not talking about that. There will be, should be, needs to be sovereign nations responding in their own interests. But there's also got to be something bigger. It's just like each individual in this room. You wouldn't be here. You would not be here. You wouldn't be involved in the things you're involved in, this issue in particular, if this was all about, in your own mind, your own self-interest. Of course, we all and each have a self-interest. And there's nothing wrong with that. We better all have a self-interest. But it's something bigger than a self-interest. And that's what drives a great society, and that's what sustained our society. And I think that's what you're getting at as much as any one thing. Then you work through the specifics of how you do that and all those instruments of power that I talked to about, that you apply them. You bring them together in a strategic way that then structures a strategy. And it always has to be regional. I think that's one of the big mistakes we've made over the years, that we've tried to take Iraq in some kind of an isolation in a vacuum tube, and Iran over here, and then we'll do a little of this over here, and then maybe some of this, the Israeli-Palestinian issue over here. No, it is all knitted together. It needs to be approached from a regional dynamic. There'll be no peace in Afghanistan or Pakistan without the Iranians involved some way and the Indians on the other border. Not because I say it, that's just the reality of it. That's the reality of it. I will conclude with this. Engagement is important. I think we are entering an era of engagement and cooperation, accommodation. And accommodation is not necessarily a bad word. Certain things you cannot accommodate. You can't accommodate killers. You can't accommodate terrorists. But you must accommodate countries' national interests and their own optics and their ideas. Or we will never accommodate any possibility to bring a better world, a safer world, if we don't do that. I think we are opening that new era. Engagement is not appeasement. Engagement is not appeasement. And the more of us who believe that and understand that, then I think that will not only reflect our future policies in this country, but it will anchor our policies with a purpose. Thank you. Be glad to respond to questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. We have about now you can see why John Hamry insisted that he be part of our Smart Power Commission and why he's so missed in the Senate. We have time. We have about 20 minutes for questions. Once again, please identify yourself, name, and affiliation, and we'll start in the back over there.
My name is Nihal Gunawardena. Senator, you're a much admired policymaker, and I don't want you to be misinformed. The oldest school for foreign relations in the United States was formed in 1933 by Harvard University and Tufts at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy.
Well, if I have bad information, I apologize to Harvard and Tufts. But I was told and I read that the 1957 School of International Affairs was the first school devoted to that one issue at American University. So if I have bad information, I'll stand corrected, and I will go back to American University and ask him what the hell the deal is.
Sherry Mueller, a graduate of both Fletcher and American University.
Well, I'm glad you're here.
We'll talk later. But, Senator, many of us in this room are involved in trying to help the U.S. Congress understand the value of programs like the International Visitor Program of the U.S. Department of State, the Fulbright Program, and other exchanges of all kinds. Now that you've left the Senate, what advice do you have for us to make cogent arguments to your former colleagues? Thanks so much.
Well, thank you for all what you do and the organizations, institutions represented here in that effort. And I am well aware of those efforts over the years, and I've tried to support your efforts in every way I could over the years. Your point's a very important point. And how you do that, I think, first, keep doing what you're doing. But what really makes a big difference is having as wide a base in this country of individuals representing districts and states. So when they come to Washington, and it's the same approach everybody takes on every issue, a congressman or a senator sits down and listens to respected members of his or her state and district, and that helps. First of all, it helps you get in, it helps you make your case, and it helps educate the member of Congress on the importance of these programs. And education, information, as we all know, is essentially the essence of anything, because you must be informed. You must be somewhat conversant, educated on issues. And if you're not, then most likely you're going to drift or eventually go right over the cliff and make the wrong decision. So there's no magic to this. You all know that out there. You work hard at it. You just keep coming back. But widen your base as much as you can, because that really affects members of Congress. As I said earlier in my remarks, just remember politics reflects society, that members of Congress react. They respond. Rarely are we in situations where they can lead. Congress wasn't set up to lead. I mean, it really wasn't. I mean, when you really read the Federalist Papers and most of the dynamics of what Congress was about, what was the responsibility of Congress? A senator, a congressman. Both houses, as you know, have totally different responsibilities. And so 535 members of the Congress, I mean, we all think we should be president, of course, but or at least Secretary of State or something, but you can't do that. Now, I know that some of my former colleagues think they can and will continue, and we're always going to have that. But the best I think you can hope from in the Congress on these kinds of things is an educated Congress, is an informed Congress, and then through the committee structures and through decision making, they come to the right conclusions. But presidents must lead on this, and then all the attendant organizations out there that are critical to a democracy. And my sense is, your organizations represented here today are going to be more critical, more relevant to the future of this country and policymaking than ever before. And if for no other reason I say that, is because the president, his team, members of Congress are inundated every second of every day with a crisis, with an immediate problem. And you are whipsawed and ricocheted, and the time that you have to think, there is no time. Now, I've said often over the years that I would like to see a president, rather than go to every county fair and go everywhere and just run around every second of every day, I'd like to see a president actually take 3 or 4 hours to sit alone in the Oval Office or wherever he wants to sit and just stare out the window and actually think. Now, by the way, I don't mean to be critical of any one president or any. Their jobs are huge, huge jobs. But unless we slow it down enough for our leaders to think a little bit, and that's why these organizations are going to be so important, because the Smart Power Commission, does anybody really believe the Defense Department or State Department would have had the capability, first of all, to draw on the talent? I mean, I was the weak link in it, but you look at the talent that was in that on that commission, the experience on that commission, and you heard from some of them this morning. The State Department can't do that. The Defense Department, not because they don't have smart people over there, but because every day is consumed, every second, with something. Now, you can have internal reviews and so on and so on, but to actually produce a document like that, it has to come from the outside, and you want it to come from the outside. That's one of the reasons it's so important. You draw upon the kinds of experiences represented by those commissioners. And CSIS and these organizations here, other organizations, I'm chairman of the Atlantic Council, Brookings, all these organizations do tremendously good work, as well as other institutions represented here. But you will be more important than you've ever been.
Thank you, Senator, for the great presentation. Dr. Mabry, I'm the director of MITRE Corporation's initiative in corporate and pardon me, in smart power. My question is actually about your comments about Secretary Gates and, of course, the State Department. I had the pleasure of serving on the Defense Science Board studies on both strategic communication and human dynamics, which actually recommended exactly what you just said. And by the way, one other comment, I just flew down from Boston, and it's wonderful to hear the comments about the Fletcher School. It's clear that
we cleared that up.
It's clear that the government, as you just said, can't do it. The Defense Science Board recommended the creation of a Center for Global Engagement. It was wonderful to hear you use the word engagement. I wonder if you could comment about either that particular proposal and or what expectation you have that Congress would actually take some action. And interestingly, just a footnote, in our study, one of the interesting things we heard was not the government saying, which we're hearing now from our leadership, we can't necessarily do it. We actually heard from the NGOs and a number of other independent international organizations, we want to work with you, but we can't necessarily work directly with the U.S. government, which is one of the motivations of the proposal. So I'm interested in your thoughts on that.
Well, that's an important point, and it's a very relevant part of the overall scheme here and the scope of what we're all trying to do and what the government's going to be dealing with and continue to deal with on trying to find ways to get these documents and this perspective and this information and understanding down to where it needs to go and then work it into the larger scope of policy. As I said, and you know this, this process, any process, is imperfect. I mean, you're going to have a certain amount of trial and error, what works, what doesn't work. You always have personalities and things. You've always got the personality of leadership, the personality of a president's team, the personality of a national security advisor, a secretary of state, a secretary of defense. Each of those personalities have their own individual thoughts about where something should go. They don't necessarily always agree. The president is the president, but still he does not pick, I hope this never occurs, weak people. He picks strong people, and strong people have strong opinions, and so that's a factor that is also part of all this. Specific issues that you bring up that the NGOs raised are also part of the imperfection of the process. You just have to work it through. But I come down to this as the real answer to your question. There is no substitute for leadership. Things just don't happen. As I started my comments this morning about Eisenhower, those 8 years, a lot of things could have happened. The Suez Canal crisis in 1956. If Eisenhower would have sided with the French and the British and not drawn the line, we'd see a whole different situation today. And some of these other kinds of things. That's leadership. And when we get into these areas you're talking about, leadership has to be very clear, purposeful, and bring a consensus together to activate all the resources that you need to bring in NGOs and different groups into the thinking of narrowing and channeling what you want to produce. Too often in Washington, too often I think in any institution, it's nobody's fault, it's just the way it is, that we drift, we get off track. And in my opinion, if there is one principal dominating factor that was most responsible for this global financial crisis, is that all of us weren't paying attention. We were drifting. And you can take Wall Street greed, you can take sloppy regulators, you can take the Congress not paying attention, take a whole bunch of things, and all that's part of it. But when leadership drifts, when institutions drift, for example, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, some of us saw that coming years ago. I introduced a bill in 2001 warning that there was systemic risk with what they were doing. And the reason, as much as any other reason that I said that, is because Fannie and Freddie had so drifted from the original charter. Fannie and Freddie are both congressionally chartered institutions. Their charter is very clear why we set them up, why the Congress, why the government, why the people of this country set up Fannie and Freddie Mac. There's a very clear charter and mission. They were way over here from that charter. Now, I'm not an expert on any of this, but as I was on the banking committee, was a senior member, chairman of the Securities Oversight Subcommittee, so I paid a little attention to this. It wasn't that I was any smarter than anybody else. I watched that as far as what factors into my own thinking on these things. So you could take that Fannie Freddie example and apply it to everything. Derivatives, subprime mortgages that were wrapped and rewrapped and rewrapped, selling them. People didn't even know what they were buying. The ratings agencies were saying they were AAA, many of them. The ratings agencies were on the payroll of the institutions they were rating because they were getting millions of dollars in consulting fees. Now, as we look through the rearview mirror, say, my God, well, of course. That's my point. We just all got sloppy, and we let things just drift. Consequently, what happens, always happens, there was a major implosion. And so I know you may think that's a little abstract an answer from where you were with your more specific question, but not really. I mean, it's leadership. And you've got to have – leadership has to pay attention. It's any organization, and many of you run organizations. You have to pay attention every day to your budget, to your people, to your mission, to your contributors, to your stakeholders. You've got to watch every day. Are you moving in the direction that you're supposed to be moving in? And that's the answer. Yes. Yes.
Hi, my name is Mindy Reiser. I've worked for the Fulbright program in a number of international education projects. I'd like your advice in terms of a very sticky issue. We're encouraging international students coming here. We're encouraging exchanges. But in an economic downturn, people are frightened for holding onto their jobs. They see outsiders as threats. How can we turn this around and encourage these exchanges and not see this as a zero-sum game?
Well, again, you have brought up a very poignant issue and a very, very legitimate question, which we're dealing with, everybody is every day. I think the answer to that is, and first, I don't believe there's any simple, easy, quick answer. But here would be my answer. Everything you are doing, everything everyone in this room has been doing, associations that you have, why you're here today, is addressing this issue. What does that mean? That means the entire arc of internationalism, globalism. Now, it's imperfect. It's like trade. You know, trade is not a guarantee. Trade is an opportunity. There are winners and losers in trade. There's a great law that I don't know if it's ever been written down. I don't think it's in any constitution, but it's been around since man has been around, I assume. I wasn't there, but I assume. It's called the law of comparative advantage. And you never beat that law. That law governs everything in life. So, textiles, automobiles. Well, my grandfather worked in textile mills. My dad did. Well, shouldn't I? I mean, it's a birthright. No, go back and read little Arnold Toynbee, or just a little bit of history. There's no birthright of jobs. The world moves along. It moves ahead. And you want the world to move ahead because as the world moves ahead, as standards of living rise, comes with that more stability, more security, more investment, more opportunities, better futures. Now, there are raggedy parts to that, I know. But so we've got to make the link, to answer your question, with this, the internationalism of what's good for our country overall. We can't just pick and choose. If we're going to be the leader of the world, if we are going to do the things that I think most Americans want our country to do and be who we are, you can't then just decide to pick and choose which standards and laws and regulations you're going to live by. I mean, the torture memos, Geneva Convention was a good example of that. Well, we signed all these, and we kind of led the world in this, and we put ourselves up on a higher plateau of standard of conduct. But, you know, these terrorists, you know, they're animals, and you so what if you waterboard them and torture them? Wait a minute. America, you're proclaiming one standard here, but then based on your own interpretation and your own rationalization logic, then you're adhering to a whole different standard. You can't have that. And so what we've got to do is get underneath all of this so that we can project to the people of this country an understanding that this is good for all of us, what's going on here. The interchange, the engagement. We want people investing in this country. I mean, I can give you hundreds of pages of documents and information which you already have about how much investment comes into this country. If we start locking that out by shutting out students from China, I mean you know how much of our national debt the Chinese own. Now, if the Chinese decide that they're not going to buy our securities anymore, and they're about two-thirds of their $2 trillion in foreign reserves are holdings, our U.S. securities. Now, if the Chinese decide that isn't a very good investment, if you remember the president of China made things go wobbly a couple of months ago by saying, I'm not sure we're getting our return, what would happen is that the ability for us, the United States, to make payments monthly on the interest, not on the principal, but the interest of our national debt, I don't know where you get the money. And you take then not only China, but many countries of Asia, who also hold a lot of our securities. That's just but one example to use to people. Say you can't close the doors like that because investments in plants. Some of my colleagues from the South who have tinges of protectionism wrapped around them, and maybe not as enlightened as some might want. Both Democrats and Republicans, by the way. I remind them occasionally. How many foreign automobile plants are in Alabama? Now, if the Japanese had not put those plants in there, tens of thousands of Alabamans who have good jobs, and those cars are being sold, pension plans, futures, they wouldn't be there. They wouldn't be there. So I think we have to make those kinds of arguments. I know it's difficult, and because, unfortunately, in politics, and this is never going to change, but often find ourselves playing to the lowest political common denominator for the moment. And we've got all these bright people like Rush Limbaugh and Lou Dobbs and others who truly educate and inform and elucidate. But, you know, there was a political party, many of you know, in this country in the 1840s, and they called themselves the Know-Nothings. And they were very proud of that. Of course, it didn't last very long, but they had a hell of a lot of fun, I suppose, with it. But they were actually proud of that. And they were anti-immigrant. They were anti—and I'm not sure how many of them thought that they were real Americans, by the way, in 1840. I used to kid my friend, former senator from Colorado, Ben Nighthorse Campbell, that Ben probably was the only real American in the Senate. But I said, even you, Ben, I mean, your people had to come down through the Aleutian Islands, so I'm not sure we can say you're real American either. But it's those kinds of things, and you're always going to be dealing with those facets, and we just have to rise above it, make a better argument, be more cogent, and win the day. And certainly the facts are on our side. Thank you very much.
For those of you who did not get lunch before the talk, please help yourself, and I'm sure this will be enough for seconds as well. We will start with our next session in about 20 minutes, so you have a little bit of a break. Thank you so much.